Okay, this is week one on Albrecht Dürer. The bulletin says it's got 3 weeks, but I think I told him I was going to do it in four, but I think he'll be okay adding a week to it. The first 2 weeks we'll be talking about just a biography of Dürer. First week, the formative years. The second week, his latter years and things going on in the Reformation. And week three, we'll be talking about his woodcuts, you know, the process, and then we'll look at some of his woodcuts and kind of analyze them a little bit. And then week four, look at the engraving and the process of doing engraving, and also look at a few of his engravings and kind of analyze them as well. Along the way, I'll do some rabbit trails on things that I think that are important. And we'll start actually probably with the first rabbit tail. He was born in Nuremberg, Germany, May 21st, 1471. And to talk about Nuremberg, there is a picture of it in 1493, I believe. It's in Bavaria. It's about 100 miles north of Munich. The first written information about Nuremberg is around 1050 AD. It was a free imperial city, and what a free imperial city is, they were a self-ruling city that had a lot of autonomy, and they had a representative. They were representing the imperial diet, and they also reported directly to the emperor, the Holy Roman Emperor. In contrast to a territorial city, which would have a local prince that was overseeing them. So if Tacoma was a free imperial city, we would report to Donald Trump. But since we're not, we report to Jay Inslee instead. So you can kind of see the issue there, that more people in the middle of things. Nuremberg was a commerce center. It was located on the Pegnitz River, and with that came money, and with money came affluence, and people who had money liked to spend their money on art and science and physics. A couple of the better known were a Willibald Pirckheimer and a Bernard Walther. They would be kind of analogous to the Medici family in Florence, which we all know quite well for supporting many of the great artists in the Renaissance and beyond. The arts and sciences flourished in Nuremberg. To give you an idea, I have a really hard time pronouncing this guy's name, but is Regiomontanus. He built the first observatory in Europe. Martin Behaim, he was a cosmographer who designed the first terrestrial globe. Peter Heel invented the watch. Hans Bullmann was the first person to set up a true astronomical clock. You know, that's a clock with the little moon and the sun and everything going around and everything. It was a center for organ makers, glass painters, and goldsmiths. And this wasn't just consumed regionally, but it was all over Europe would seek out the wares that were created in Nuremberg. The better known sculptors at the time was Adam Kraft and Peter Vischer. Adam Kraft's work, and this is Peter Vischer's work. They are very typical of the high Gothic style. And then we have the painter Michael Wolgemut. Painting that he did, and then this is a portrait of him done by Albrecht Dürer about 3 years before He died in 1519. The first paper mill in Germany was created in Nuremberg. The second printing press was set up by an Anton Koberger. And who set up the first one? Thank you. Of course, it has to come from the history teacher. Come on, guys. And with that, the mostly the books that were being printed were Bibles and Psalters and prayer books. But it also attracted writers to the area, so more and more things would be printed there. Koberger also printed the Nuremberg Chronicles, which was human history story related around the Bible, and then a few of the more important Western cities. It was first written in Latin by Hartmann Schedel, and it was translated into German by George Alt and printed in 1493. And it is one of the first and most successful books that were printed that integrated illustrations and text. So, needless to say, you can see why Nuremberg was the center of the German Renaissance. Albrecht Dürer the Elder, which is Albrecht Dürer's father, came to Nuremberg from Hungary in 1455. His family name is actually Ágtos, which is derived from the word ato, meaning door in Hungarian. He worked as an assistant to a goldsmith named Hoppler, whose daughter Barbara he married in 1467. They rented a home from the Perkheimer family. You remember we talked about them a little earlier, one of the rich families in the area. Wilbald Perkheimer was born 6 months before Albrecht was born, and they were lifelong friends. Albrecht is the second son of 18 children. Anton Koberger is his godfather. Now, who was Koberger again? He is the man who started the printing press there in Nuremberg. And that will become important later in Dürer's life. He learned to read and write at a very early age at a neighborhood school. And after learning how to read and write, his father started teaching him the goldsmith work. And in 1484, at the age of 13, he did a self-portrait of himself looking in a mirror. And there it is. And up there in the corner, what is written there is that this I have drawn for myself from the looking glass in the year 1484, when I was still a child. This is something that Dürer did quite a bit. He would do drawings and paintings, and then he would write stuff up in the corner to kind of tell you what it is. And it's kind of a unique thing. His father, seeing that he was very gifted in art, did the wise thing, and he apprenticed him to Michael Wolgemut to serve him for 3 years. And here we'll go on another one of our little rabbit trails. The guild and workshops, how that system worked in this time period, and we'll concentrate mostly on how it works in Germany, because they were a little different in France, a little different in Italy, a little different in England and whatnot. The guild and workshop system came to maturity around 1300, and in some cases, the privileges still held today, being a member of a guild. If some of you remember, I went to Austria in early 2000s to a wood carving school there. The guild system is still alive and well there, and I was told what I would have to do to be considered a master carver in Austria. And it amounted to 2 years of an apprenticeship, which was a school there. And then you would sit for a week-long exam where they would have you, you would have to understand the history of the wood carving, and then you would have to be able to design different things, whether it's three-dimensional or architectural, and then you would have to execute something you designed there in the school or in the test, and then they would approve it or not approve it. And then you would become a master carver. The two main guilds at the time were merchant guilds and craft guilds, and we're only going to be really concerned about the craft guilds. These were designed to control the labor and the production and the trade of your goods, and also, very importantly, the instruction of other people to learn the same trade. In a workshop, you started out as an apprentice. An apprentice could be paid or not paid. There was typically a set time. Doing research, I've read about some apprenticeships that were set for a four-year period. And at the end of a four-year period, they're going to be paid X number of guilders or florins or whatever it was. And the master ended the apprenticeship 4 months early, so he didn't have to pay him. So there are people in business everywhere that don't do things right. In German, it's called a Lehrjahre, which is your learning years. And in that time, you're just learning the basic skills of whatever craft that you have chosen. The next step after that is you become a journeyman, which means you're licensed to be an employee. And in Germany, they call that the Wanderjahr, which is you spend that time going around to other places and learning, you're working for other masters, but you're learning little bits of the trade as you go. One of the things that would happen sometimes to journeymen, one of the wood carvers that I admire so much, Tilman Riemenschneider, he was the head of the guild in Würzburg, Germany, and he had his own workshop. And the way he was able to control anybody else from becoming a wood carver is he would keep them on as journeymen, but you would only learn how to carve hair. You would only learn how to carve hands. You would only learn how to carve feet. You'd learn how to do drapery. So you're never able to learn the whole process, because part of becoming a master was submitting your masterpiece to the guild, and then the guild would give you thumbs up or thumbs down whether you could become a master. And once you became a master, then you could open up your own workshop in that city. Wolgamut, who the workshop that Dura apprenticed at, is really only best known for being the teacher of Dura. He is not known much for his own work himself. One of the things that Wolgamut did that actually helped Dura was he had copied 48 engravings of Martin Schongauer, who is one of the best known engravers of the time, and he was only really surpassed by Dura once Dura matured. And here's an example of Schongauer's work. You can see in Albrecht Dürer's work that he was influenced greatly by Schongauer, but the two were never to meet. As an apprentice, he was learning the technical process of the chemistry in the painting, since he was being apprenticed by a painter mostly, or he was mostly Wolgamut was known as a painter, but he also learned the engraving. He finished his apprenticeship in 1490, and that would be the age of 19. And then the next step was to begin his journeyman or his wonder year time. He has said very little about this in his writings, and one of the things that Dura did later in life, he was very good at recording where he is at and what he is doing, and actually in some cases of telling us how much he would sell something for. And so that's one of the ways that we know, you know, what people were being paid at the time. The one thing that he did say about his time as an apprentice, that he had suffered much from his fellow apprentice. So Dura was kind of a mellow, meek kind of guy, and he was easily bullied. How are we doing on time? Because I know we got started late. You know, like usual, when I'm doing notes, I never know if I've got too much or if I don't have enough. But we will get through the part that I know that I need to get through today, and we might end early or we might end late. I don't know. Probably more likely early. What we can discern from the next 4 years of his life is that he possibly went to Basel and Strasbourg in 1491, or between 1490 and 1491. There is a painting that is in Strasbourg that has his initials on it, the way he signed it, but the authenticity of that painting is in doubt. In 1492, he went to Colmar, which is where the master engraver, Martin Schongauer, had his shop, but he had died the previous year. But his brothers welcomed him with open arms, and he spent time there learning more about engraving and doing woodcuts. And Martin, the younger brother Ludwig, the younger brother of Martin, was the leader of the school at that time, and gave him a drawing that Martin had done as a gift. So he was very well accepted there. In 1493, he went to Strasbourg, and there is a very good chances that he actually took up residence there, because there are a painting of a couple, a portrait of a couple from the city, but nobody knows who these two people are. And the, so I got that, actually I don't have that in my, in 1493. What I have here now is some work that he had done as an apprentice and during his journeyman time. This is a watercolor that he did as an apprentice. And then another watercolor he also did when he was an apprentice. And as you'll see from the next slide, that he did also in 1489, so the year before, is one of his first woodcuts. So you can kind of, I don't know how well you guys can see that. You can see that there is, you know, a heavy Gothic influence. His earlier work is more of a high Gothic style, and you know, later as the Renaissance picked up, his style changed a lot. You can see a little bit of the change already happening from the influence from Italy, because if you see in a lot of the drapery, it's got sharp angles. What they called that in which is a typical Gothic motif, what they called that when I was in school, they called it crushed tin, because that's what it looks like. You got a tin can and you just kind of crush it, and so you have very sharp angles. But you can also, you can see on Christ that, you know, the influence from Italy is coming in how more natural and flowing the drapery is. So you can kind of already see a transition from Gothic to the Renaissance styles. You know, I could look that up and tell you next week. It's not very big. Most of the woodcuts are not large prints. A lot of the woodcuts at that time, you know, since most people couldn't read, a lot of them they were used kind of like tracts. You know, instead of handing somebody that, you know, if you heard the gospel today, they'd hand out tracts of, you know, whatever they wanted somebody to learn about the Bible, about Christ. What's that? Yeah, they were pretty small. And, you know, I've dabbled in doing woodcuts, and I'm like, yeah, no thanks. There's a lot to that, to be able to get that amount of detail. No, the watercolors were all still when he was in Nuremberg as an apprentice. That's a good question. You know, because the watercolors, they're earth-based back then. And, you know, because watercolors, they really don't last well. To see a 500-year-old watercolor is pretty rare. You know, it's not something you do for the long term. Let's see what else. You know, I don't know. They're, you know, the thing with museums in Europe, most of them don't know what they have because they've been piling stuff up for, you know, hundreds of years, and then somebody, yeah, only multiply it by a factor of 10 or 20, and you know, it's just astounding what they'll find sometimes. I remember reading about a church that was being refurbished or restored in Spain, and it had a beautiful fresco ceiling, and, you know, the Spanish version of Michelangelo had done the original fresco in there, but they figured it had been destroyed and everything, you know, whenever, and one of the workers saw a pigeon fly out of a hole in the ceiling, so they're like, huh, I wonder what's in there, so he gets his camera, sticks it in there, ka-chink, pulls it out, there's the original fresco. It had been covered over because a lot of times, art was so prevalent and so readily available. I mean, just for example, in Florence at this time, there were more wood carvers in Florence than butchers. So that tells you how important art was to the people at that time. But like anything, you know, it would come in and out of style. And when something went out of style, you know, you got rid of it, you covered it up, you know, it didn't really matter, or you altered it to whatever your needs were at the time. And that's what happened to this fresco in Spain. You know, you would think, you know, the church kind of keeps records of these kind of things, that, you know, we don't like this guy's stuff anymore, so we're going to cover it over. We paid, you know, $400,000 for new ceiling. You know, nothing. So it's very, very typical of what would happen. So this he did in 1490, oil painting, and it is a crest of his family's, his mother's family and their family. And remember, I told you that the Atos meant door in Hungarian. So the Dura family crest has an open door as the on their shield there. And He did these in 1493. This is while he was in on his journey. And that's a picture of mom and dad, or paintings of mom and dad. And then the this self-portrait, this next one here, he did in 1494, and this is, and he did this in Strasbourg, and he did this to send. Well, I'll just read here because it. During his time, the artist's father and Hans Frey, a high-ranking Nuremberg citizen, were negotiating the marriage of Albrecht and Agnes Frey. As the agreement was reached, Dürer made a self-portrait, which he sent to the young lady. The portrait was meant to sustain his candidacy and to show how serious his intentions were. It shows a handsome young man holding in his hand a piece of blue flower named Manstrue, which means man's faithfulness. So you can see it's right down here. And he most likely did this more out of duty than out of actual desire. Marriages were still being arranged at that time. And he was doing the duty that his family required of him. And, 10:30. Okay, that's where I'm going to end today, and next week we will get into some of more of his later life and then events that he was involved in during the Reformation, and then also what was happening in Nuremberg at the time, and any other questions?
Interesting hairstyle.
What's that? Yeah, you know, this isn't his best work. It's interesting what he chose his soon-to-be wife, what he wanted her to see. So I guess I could be accused of that, too, because one of the first pictures I sent to Tamara when we were courting, I was in India with a python around my neck and a cobra in my hand. So that was one of the first pictures she saw of me. And she still married me, so we're good.
You started off with talking about, is there distinctives? I guess, what are the distinctives? If I saw a painting, all I know, well, not being an artist, but what distinctives would I look for to see a Renaissance art as opposed to modern art? Are there distinctives?
Well, the things that are different is that there's a set of rules that are around, you know, classical art. There's a lot of things you can do within that rule set to be able to express what you want to express. And, you know, for example, one of the things that Dürer does that's a little different than the Italians were always looking at the outside person. So that's why they were always looking, you know, for the perfect physique, the first perfect look for everything. And Dürer, when he was, I mean, if we go back to, we go back to this woodcut that he did. He was trying to show the inner person through the outward looks. So sometimes, you know, there's ugly people, and there's people in tormented, you know, that look tormented and everything. And he's trying to express that, you know, what's going on inside with the outside. But he still was working within the rules. You know, there are basic rules to human proportion. You know, there's well, you know, when... Well, yeah, you know, and I mean, I don't know if you guys remember when I did the class on art 10 years ago, if any of you were there, I put up 16 portraits that Picasso did of a woman. I put up 16 pictures of women, and I asked everybody to see if they could match the woman to the portrait. And nobody could ever get past getting one right. And the reason they could only get one right, because all 16 of those portraits are the same woman. But you can't tell that by looking at them. And, just self-expression for self-expression's sake. I mean, I thought, that's why I think it's so good to see that, he was standing in front of a white painting that somebody did. You know, when I did an arts show in New York with my wife, this huge canvas, I mean, golly, it was 6 feet wide, 10, 12 feet tall, lime green with an orange dot, $15,000, and it was sold. And if I'd known that, I still wouldn't do it. So, I don't know if that answers your question or not, but... even though I'm alive today, what I'm doing out in the narthex, I'm trying to do in a classical way. I'm trying to keep proportions, within the realm of reality. I'm not, messing up eyes or just putting blobs and calling them humans or something like that. And if you have to guess what something is, that's usually a pretty good sign that it's modern art. one of the things the Impressionists did, what they did different than the classical was that they still kept perspective and proportions, but they were using, instead of blending colors together to get the color they want, they would put those three colors together to give the appearance of that color. So you're getting the impression that this isn't blue and red, but it's actually purple. And that was one of the things that they did. That's why he made the comment, there was still some merit in what they were doing. But, as most revolutions go, it just continued going south. I mean, how many times did Picasso reinvent himself? I mean, he's got his blue period and his cube period and his, I don't know, whatever periods. And Madonna. Oh, yeah. But you know what? In my opinion, Picasso is the biggest waste of talent in the 20th century, because I saw some of his work when he was in school. The guy was an incredible artist. But he decided to go off and do whatever he did. So, any other questions? Related, unrelated? All right. That would be it.